Hey, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast on rights and liberties. This is Jenny joining you for our week 3 discussion. And this podcast episode is another one that I'm pulling from my constitutional law class that was held in the fall of 2024. The podcast is going to line up very closely with the slides, but as with last time, the slide numbers when I describe them won't necessarily line up. And I will be adding in a few bits and pieces here related to our rights and liberties class, mostly towards the end when I'm discussing the assignments. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and cut myself off there and let you roll right into the podcast. Enjoy. We are now entering week 3, which means we are transitioning away from the more general understanding of approaches and interpretations of the Constitution to thinking about the processes by which the court operates. This week is really about getting a better understanding of the court's functioning, its design, its structure, and then we're going to wrap up with discussions around how to approach and analyze a Supreme Court decision or opinion, as well as discussion of some of our upcoming assignments. What I'd like for you to do at this point, as I've recommended in past podcasts, is to open up the week 3 slides. The slides for this week are entitled Week 3 Slides, Justices in Process. So if you can go ahead and open that up, that will walk you through what I'm talking about. Okay, let's jump right into slide 2 and cover quickly the objectives for this week. In this week, we are going to learn more about the processes for judicial selection and the politics of this process, as well as the process for case selection and decision-making procedures that are used by the justices of the court. I'm going to have you do a quote-unquote podcast project where I ask you to do a little research around a justice of your choice that you find most intriguing. And to wrap things up today, I'm going to talk about our upcoming assignments, the legal arguments and reflection papers, as well as the survey for the case selections. This week, you're going to go ahead and fill out that survey to let me know which cases you're most interested in. And then by next week, I will give you your assigned cases for both the legal arguments and reflection papers. Before we jump too far into anything else, click over to slide 3, and I want you to take a minute, truly, 60 seconds to 2 minutes, to write out your understanding of a few styles of interpretation of the Constitution. Specifically, how do you understand and conceive of living constitution or living constitutionalism? How would you explain something like consequentialism? And how do you conceive of originalism? I'd like for you to try to write out these explanations as if you were going to explain it to someone who's never taken any American politics classes before, which is certainly challenging, but an interesting way to try and engage us in thinking about how to explain without getting into too much jargon or specificity. I really want you to think in general terms here. So take a break, take that 1 to 2 minutes, and try to write out your explanation of each of those 3 methods of interpretation. If you'd like, you're welcome to send me what you wrote up, and I can give you some feedback on that. But of course, this is just an individual thinking slash writing exercise, so if you'd prefer to just keep it on your own, that's no problem. Just want to make sure we're checking in to see how we're understanding different concepts and ideas. And with those methods of interpretation, because of their complexity, it really is important to kind of get a sense of how we might talk about them or explain them to others. All right, let's move into the material portion of today's slides, beginning with the process of appointment. Now, if you have already read the chapter, this will be a fair amount of review because I'm talking about the processes detailed in that chapter. So, again, this is considered a high-level overview. Don't feel like you need to spend a lot of time on this if you felt that you really understood the process as described in the textbook, but I do like to review it just to make sure we walk away with the same kind of high points or 30,000-foot view of everything that goes on with the selection process, at least when it comes to judges for this first part of the chapter. The process of nominating a Supreme Court justice is pretty political nowadays, and it hasn't always been so political, but it definitely has been overwhelmingly a process that is marked by dynamics of conflict and contention, at least since the 1800s. So each justice is brought onto the court through a nomination. That nomination is made by the president. That's one of the powers of the presidency that is allocated to that individual. And yet the president doesn't just simply do this on their own. They consider the input of insiders and professionals within the field who know who to recommend. Once the president has received that input and suggested an individual or given a name, the Senate Judiciary then begins to review that individual's history, their record, their background. Pretty much all the research you can imagine going into one person happens at this point in time. Now, at the same time that this research is going on, the nominated individual is going to be meeting with senators on that judiciary committee to try and build up support for their candidacy. And then eventually we transition into the public side of the process, which is the public televised hearings. These have only been televised since the 1980s, beginning with Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And for the most part, these tend to be pretty sensationalized, at least, in terms of what we get to see. The hearings usually are several days long. We wouldn't really tune into a lot of it, mostly because it is generally a back and forth to try and figure out the technicalities of being a justice. But at times, it does get very heated, and we've seen that a lot in the last few hearings. After those hearings wrap up, the committee takes an up or down vote, essentially, on the candidate to decide if they're going to recommend them to the full Senate when the full Senate votes or not. And at times we may end up without a committee determination on that if they are quote unquote deadlocked, meaning they have the same number of upvotes as downvotes. The last step in the process is the entire Senate, all 100 members, being able to vote on that individual. And at this point, a simple majority, or 50% plus one, is required for approval. Generally, that would be 51 total votes, but at times when a senator may opt out, it is possible that we could end up with just 50 and that goes ahead with the confirmation. And in fact, that is what we have seen a few times in our recent past. I had mentioned before we've had some contentious hearings, and on our slide 6, I presented you with some links to a few hearings that really do show that tendency. The first of these is the hearing for Brett Kavanaugh, which was maybe the most contentious that we've seen in the last decade or two decades, to be honest. And the other link is for the hearings for Ketanji Brown Jackson, which wasn't nearly as contentious, but still had situations where you can see the back and forth between the candidate and the senators, and you can also see the politicization of the entire process, where one individual might be asking a question that's really intended to be a gotcha, and the candidate avoids answering that question by talking around it. Take a few minutes, watch those videos. Don't watch the full video for each one because they are quite long, obviously, with hearings running several days, that's a real possibility. But just taking a few minutes to kind of witness the dynamics if you haven't seen them before is helpful for understanding just how political this process can be. All right, at this point, I hope you took the time to watch a few videos. You can also find several nomination hearings recorded and available to you on YouTube at any point in time. These are broadcast live when a new nominee is being considered for a position on the Supreme Court, so you can also technically watch them live. Not that I've ever been in the room while they're having these hearings, but I would recommend watching on video. It allows you to skip through and move ahead toward any real substance you want to see, or any fireworks you might be interested in witnessing. On slide 7 is a listing of all of our current justices that are on the U.S. Supreme Court. It's 9 total individuals, 6 of whom have been nominated by a Republican president at this point, and 3 who have been nominated by a Democratic president. This is a really high point of contention among many individuals who take an interest in the Supreme Court, because this type of division with 6 from one party versus 3 from another is considered highly imbalanced. Now, I want to make one thing clear with that last statement. Saying 6 are from one party and 3 are from another doesn't mean that the Supreme Court justices themselves would come out and say that they are blatantly Republican or blatantly Democratic. But we do know that the justices tend to lean in the same direction as the president who nominates them. So we also tend to associate each justice with the presidential party of the president who nominated them. Now, on the next slide, I have a question for you to consider in relation to this entire process. Do you think that the appointment process as it exists, as explained on slide 5 and talked through with you now, and maybe as you've witnessed in those hearing videos, is this an acceptable way of selecting judges to the Supreme Court? And I want you to keep in mind, this is a lifetime tenure position. Is this the best option we have for process? And why? Or why not? What are your thoughts on that? Moving into a bit more discussion about the leanings of each justice, what you can see on slide 9 is a statistical measure based on the judges' voting records of how much they tend to align with their appointer, aka the president who selected them. And generally what you will see there is an indication of which way the president leaned. Was it conservative or liberal? And then which way did the justice lean in relation to that? Were they 66.2% of the time voting conservative? Were they 36.9% of the time voting conservative? What this graph is meant to reflect is how much did they actually align with the president that selected them. And I think what's really interesting about this graphic is just how much it shows there's certainly not 100% alignment with one's presidential appointer. It is pretty strong on some ends of the scale, but we can also see that even on those far ends, you don't have that perfect walking in step with the party of the president. So, moving into another consideration of how partisan or party aligned, the politics have become in relation to the Supreme Court justices. If you look at slide 10, what you're going to see is how over time the votes on the justices have become drastically more party line. So we start at the bottom with Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy back in the 1980s and the votes that were taken on those individuals. What you can see on that bar graph is the breakdown of votes for that individual or confirmation votes. And then the proportion that were Republican is the red portion of the bar, and the portion that were Democratic is the blue portion of the bar, with the few independents in the Senate being registered as a purple section of the bar graph. The important trend I want for you to notice at this point in time is how much we go down in terms of overall confirmation votes. Scalia and Kennedy had nearly 100 votes in favor, even if the individuals on the other side of the lines, so-called, by that I mean people who held a different party than the president, they still supported the justices for the seat. But recently, when we look at Justices Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Coney Barrett, and Brown Jackson, you can see that the bar graph includes almost none of the other party. So Gorsuch, Coney Barrett, and Kavanaugh have almost entirely red bars, while Brown-Jackson's is almost entirely blue. This is a really important shift because we've seen a transition in the voting, in the support for candidates for the Supreme Court, and that often has very little to do with the actual qualifications of the individuals and much more to do with the party of the president at the time. There's one important additional dynamic I want to highlight, and that is when we moved from the 60 votes required to break a filibuster to really only requiring 51 votes for that. So you see these two bars, right, where the 60 votes to break a filibuster is kind of highlighted as this black line on the right-hand side, and the 50 votes for confirmation is right there in the center, and you can see that every justice has reached at least 50 votes. But what used to happen when a Supreme Court justice was not popular enough is that the Senate would basically make the move to filibuster the nomination or delay a vote. And in 2013, this all changed because under the Obama administration, there had been a lot of holdup around those filibusters. We basically had a bunch of filibusters and couldn't get to actually having a vote on a nomination. So they changed the filibuster in relation to nominations for courts and even other executive positions, I believe. So now you only have to hit 51 to go away from a filibuster. It's still the same 50 for confirmation. That's never changed. But what this means now is that as long as your party has at least 51 people in the Senate, you can get any candidate through that you want, no matter how hardline or extreme, as long as there's enough support from your party and your party is the dominant party in the Senate, you're going to go ahead and get them through. And you can kind of see these dynamics playing out with the most recent justices. Look at the votes for Gorsuch, for Kavanaugh, for Coney Barrett, and even for Brown-Jackson. Generally speaking, you see a lot less party crossover there than what you even see before with like Kagan and Sotomayor. Now, Kagan and Sotomayor and even Alito don't really have that much support from the party that's, you know, on the opposite side, but there's still an important dynamic there where there's going to be more people who are willing to support those individuals than what we see in our recent nominations. So pay attention to that filibuster. That change is a big one, and it's really affected, I believe, the way that our politics are playing more into the Supreme Court than they have in at least the last, let's say, 50 years. What I'd like to move into now is a brief discussion of the times when nominations have failed, because not every candidate for the Supreme Court moves forward to an actual vote or gets voted in. Even back in the 1980s, we did actually see candidates who were rejected, meaning they did not get a sufficient number of votes from the Senate to move forward. And the classic example of this is Robert Bork. Bork was an outspoken conservative judge, and he actually shared quite a bit more of his judicial and personal philosophies than many justices have been willing to do since, and it's probably because of his example that we now don't get so much directness in answers to the senator's questions. To be borked, so to speak, is essentially to be put out of consideration for a position as a function of sharing a lot of one's perspective, at least when it comes to the judicial nomination process. A number of other candidates have never actually had a vote, and most recently the two that I would put forth for you to consider are Harriet Myers and Merrick Garland. Now, these two individuals had very different cases. Harriet Myers was nominated by President George W. Bush, and her nomination was withdrawn within just about 1 month because she had never served as a judge. And while there is no requirement for a Supreme Court justice to serve as a judge, many individuals took this to mean it was a very bad fit and they couldn't assess her qualifications. So while she was an attorney who advised the president, her nomination was withdrawn quite quickly and she was replaced with Samuel Alito as the nominee at the time.
The final failed nomination actually really wasn't so much failed as they simply held off the vote, and that is Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland ended up being the Attorney General under the Obama administration, but he was originally put up as a nominee for the Supreme Court, and Mitch McConnell, who was the Senate leader at the time, basically refused to go forward with the vote, right? He had enough power to hold back on the vote, and therefore they delayed and never gave him an actual vote. The seat he would have been nominated for had been vacated by Justice Antonin Scalia, who'd actually passed away while he was still serving as a Supreme Court justice. Eventually, Neil Gorsuch was nominated by President Trump to fill that position. So Merrick Garland was a failed nominee, not because he couldn't have gotten the support, but because we actually just never got to a vote based on the holdup in the Senate.
All right, at this point, I want us to take a bit of a mental exercise break and do something a little different rather than just listening to me speak to you in this podcast. I want you to take about 10 or 15 minutes to do a minor research project. And in this research project, what I really want you to do is dig into one of our current 9 justices. I don't care which justice you choose, whoever you find most interesting, but I want you to look into 2 questions about those individuals, because we often hear a lot in the nomination process about the quote-unquote leanings of any justice, but we don't really know that very well, and we also don't know much about their qualifications. At least, that doesn't make the news. So please take this time, choose one of the 9 justices pictured on slide 12, and look up what was their prior training? What was their previous experience? Did they practice law in the private realm? Were they a prosecutor? Did they serve at the district court level or just the Court of Appeals? And then what is their relative position in relation to the other justices? And I'd ask you to actually kind of position them. Are they the most conservative? Are they somewhere in the middle? Are they the most liberal? Where do they land along the spectrum of the 9? Again, take a few minutes to do that and then come back to this podcast when you've had a chance to do that little bit of digging. Okay, do you know where your justice stands, at least in relation to the others? Well, slides 13 and 14 present an interesting and research-based method for trying to identify where each justice stands relative to the others as far as being more liberal or more conservative. On slide 13, what you will see are called the Martin-Quinn scores of judicial ideology. And the Martin-Quinn scores are these long-term measures which assess where each justice is relative to the median position, or the zero position on this graph, based on their voting record. So what we can see in this is the justice that's the most removed from the median position is actually Sonia Sotomayor. But following her are Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas. Again, we're looking at the distance from the zero point here, which is considered the median justice. And what we can also see in this graph is that quite a few of the justices aren't too far from what would be considered kind of a neutral midpoint. Not terribly liberal, not terribly conservative, just kind of down the middle. But this graphic makes it seem as though the justices occupy this space and they stay there, and it's a stable kind of ideology as far as being liberal or conservative. And yet we know that's also not the case. So if you move on to slide 14, what you can see is the Martin-Quinn scores, if we look at them over time, actually show how the justices shift. If you look at the top of the graph, you're looking at the period of like the 1990s, and at the bottom, we are looking at around 2022. So you can see the movement of the justices over time. Clarence Thomas, back in the 1990s, was quite a bit more conservative than the position he exists in today. And Samuel Alito was less conservative and has moved out further from that median justice position. John Roberts, our current Chief Justice, started at a more conservative position and has moved more central. While the liberal justices have generally shifted also into a more liberal position over time. So again, remember that these Martin Quinn scores and the idea of judicial philosophy, it's not a fixed set of ideas or positions. We shift over time as human beings, and so does the Supreme Court. This is, again, a measure based on their votes, so we're trying to keep in mind how are they deciding outcomes of cases and not simply trying to interpret something that they've said or use a non-empirical record to determine this. An empirical record, by the way, means we use evidence or data and we use something that's observable rather than just trying to guess. Moving past the selection of justices, let's talk about the way that cases are selected by the Supreme Court. First, we need to talk about a few key concepts, and the primary one of these is known as jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is the authority any court has to make decisions in a case. We divide jurisdiction into two types. The first type is called original jurisdiction, and original jurisdiction means that the case goes to that court for its first decision. It doesn't go to any other case courts first. There are no prior decisions on the case. That court listens to the facts of the case and applies the law and determines the outcome. With the Supreme Court, there is very limited original jurisdiction. Only cases that are disputes between states or those that involve ambassadors or high-ranking ministers would go right to the Supreme Court without going to another court first. The second type of jurisdiction is appellate jurisdiction. And appellate jurisdiction just means when a case is appealed, the court has the ability to review the prior court's decision. This is the vast majority of what the Supreme Court gets in terms of its cases. It's looking at prior decisions and really determining whether those decisions were made in a way that is consistent with the Constitution and other existing laws. So really, an appellate decision isn't so much about redetermining the facts of a case or assessing whether those facts fit with the law. It's actually about reviewing the process that was used and whether that process meets the requirements and standards we have in place throughout our court system. Now, in terms of where cases come from, saying that an original jurisdiction case comes from the states or ambassadors doesn't help to clarify where an appeals case can come from. If you move on to slide 17, what you're going to see there is a graphic that illustrates how we have a hierarchy to our courts, or a structure that's kind of like a pyramid. We have a lot of courts at the bottom, things like district courts at the federal level, or military courts, courts of appeals, tax courts, all sorts of lower level courts. Those courts, if they come to a decision that someone doesn't like, a party to a case that is, that they don't like, they can appeal it or ask for a reconsideration of the decision. That appeal will then move up to the next level. So the courts of appeals generally take on cases that are appealed from trial courts or from federal tribunals and other entities. And this is the biggest feeder to the Supreme Court, are cases that the U.S. Courts of Appeals have taken and decided on. But really, the Supreme Court can take any case it chooses. The case may have existed just at the trial court level, an appeal may not have moved forward to the U.S. Courts of Appeals. Someone can apply directly to the Supreme Court to have their case heard. And the graphic on 17 is showing you the federal court structure, but even state courts cases can be brought to the Supreme Court if the question is about a federal law or a constitutional issue. If the case is about a state law, then state Supreme Courts are supposed to be the last word, and that is where the case should end. It's rarely been the case that cases move from state Supreme Courts to the U.S. Supreme Court, but if it does, it's because there is a question of federal law or constitutional law at the heart of that case. At this point, let's take a step back and talk about the general application process, which provides the Supreme Court the opportunity to consider a case. At present, the Supreme Court considers somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 applications each year, and it truly is an application process. You submit your case to the court to be considered as an option for cases they will select and decide on themselves. Less than 1% of cases are chosen each year, so it's an extremely competitive process as far as really getting consideration by the court. For each case that is submitted, there is a memo prepared, and the memo is prepared by the Supreme Court's clerks. Each justice has four law clerks who assist them. Those clerks rotate, as in each justice gets four clerks, those clerks stay on for 1 year, and then the justice hires four new clerks. The clerks have an extremely large workload for their time with the Supreme Court. They are handling those thousands of applications, writing memos for their justice, and then the justice moves forward with creating a discuss list that they want to sit down with the other justices and vote on bringing forward. After each justice has created their list of cases that they want to discuss, they have what is known as a case conference, and they sit down and vote on whether to hear a case. A case will not go forward unless four justices want to hear it, and it's called the Rule of Four. And once four justices are interested in hearing it, it is accepted to the court, and the attorneys for each side are notified that they will be moving forward and given a date for making their arguments. I'm going to turn back for just a minute to discuss a little bit more about that memo preparation process. Now, when I say that there are thousands of applications, I truly mean thousands of applications. And with a legal case, those applications include thousands of pages of documents. So there's a lot to work through and read. And given this, seven of the justices have come together and created what's called the cert pool. And that cert pool means that they divide all of the applications for each case among the clerks of all seven justices. So we have 28 clerks working together to try and create those memos and distribute them among the seven justices. But two of the justices treat it quite separately, and that's Justices Alito and Gorsuch. They do not participate in the cert pool, and therefore their clerks have to go through all of the applications on their own, however many thousands there are, and they will create memos just for their justice. So if you were to be a Supreme Court clerk working for Justice Alito or Gorsuch, your workload could be just so much more vast and intense than those who are part of the cert pool. I've done a little graphic on slide 19 to illustrate what the cert pool would kind of look like as far as division of the seven justices into one kind of grouping, and then Justices Alito and Gorsuch separate on the side with their poor, heavily overworked four clerks doing all of the same amount as the clerks in the cert pool. So what exactly makes the cut as far as the applications? Well, there's a few standard kinds of cases that tend to move forward all the way through the process to getting a decision. One of these would be any cases that bring important questions of federal law, which the court hasn't ruled on yet or hasn't made any decision about. And that could be new laws, or that could be laws that have been in existence for a long time, which the court really hasn't answered. One such case or type of case really came about with the Trump v. Anderson case, in which the court considered, can the states take names off of ballots? And how do we manage this in the context of the 14th Amendment? A second category of cases that tend to move forward are those which are dealing with conflicting Supreme Court decisions. So we may have had a past decision and a more recent one, and they seem to be not so much coherent in terms of looking at both of them at the same time. And in that case, we need to take another case to clarify what the Supreme Court intended. A third category is where we see lower court decisions that themselves conflict with previous Supreme Court decisions. And this is going to be often where the Supreme Court asserts its authority to say we have the final say and the final word on certain questions. And generally speaking, they will reverse or overrule a prior lower court's decision. And then the final kind of standard category that gets moved forward in the case selection process is when we see lower court departures from the quote accepted and usual course of judicial proceedings. Now, this would make a lot of sense in the context of something like a pandemic, where perhaps we had to do things differently in court than we'd done in the past, and that would potentially fall in well with that kind of topic. But of course, there are other factors at play here, right? The kind of standard four categories don't really account for everything that the Supreme Court chooses.
Any case that the court chooses for an actual decision with a full opinion is also going to need to have what are known as the case or controversy factors. So it's not just those questions, those four categories, but there also have to be these other things in place in order for the Supreme Court to say, yep, we're going to take that case and we're going to make a decision. The first of these is called standing. Now, standing is a little bit of a complex idea, but it boils down to there has to be some sort of injury in the case to the parties who are involved. And sometimes they'll take a case where they determine that there is no standing, but that's usually so that they can clarify what standing is. We're actually going to see one of these cases this week when we start talking about the specific case of FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. We're also going to get a little bit into that with Atchison Hotels v. Laufer. The second factor that the court is going to look at to determine whether it's a case or a controversy is known as ripeness. This is going to sound really weird because we think of ripe as maybe like fruit, but ripeness for them means that the issue has had time to work its way through the courts and it is appropriately at the Supreme Court stage. So if we move too fast through a case and we haven't given it the time to go through, let's say, the district court and the appeals courts before making its way to the Supreme Court, we may say the issue is not ripe or the case is not ripe for selection by the Supreme Court. This also might be something that ties into whether the legal question is well developed enough. And so that's a little bit of a balancing act between, are we really ready to make a decision in this situation, or do we need a little more time to let it develop, so to speak? Number three on the list of case and controversy factors is what is known as mootness. Now, a case would be considered moot if the issue that was presented in the case is no longer a quote-unquote live issue, so that we don't need to actually address it. It's not an ongoing problem, an ongoing controversy. The controversy's over. This one is a little harder to identify clearly because we can often have situations where the topic in the case is no longer valid for consideration with the individuals who are involved in the case. The classic is Roe versus Wade. By the time that Roe v. Wade makes it to the Supreme Court, she's had the baby. The baby is not still in contention for consideration with an abortion procedure. But the Supreme Court held there that the case was not moot because this kind of situation could be encountered in the future. So even though that particular individual in that case is no longer going to be, let's say, affected as directly by the Supreme Court's decision, the issue at the heart of it is still very much live. And this is another thing we'll get to look at when we investigate the case of FBI v. FCRA. Last but not least, we have what's known as justiciability. It's a bit of a mouthful, but justiciability generally means that it is appropriately placed with the courts to decide the answer to the question rather than a political branch like Congress or the presidency. So this often comes up when we're talking about, let's say, drawing boundaries for voting and what's known controversially as the practice of gerrymandering, where we draw the lines for a voting district to ensure that one candidate wins from a specific party. Now, this happens with both parties, and it's become much more of a topic in 2025 when we discuss, you know, the state of Texas redrawing lines to add 5 more Republican seats in Congress, and then California responding back by saying they're going to redraw lines to add 5 more Democrats from California. That question seems very much one that would implicate our voting rights, but the Supreme Court has often said as long as the lines are drawn about politics and not about race, this isn't a question for the courts. It's a political question, and therefore it's not justiciable. So again, justiciability is a little bit harder to identify, but it's usually if this is something that the other branches are supposed to decide, and that's listed in the Constitution, and there's no real legal matter or legal question that the courts can decide separate from those political branches, then we would consider it not justiciable and not a case that the Supreme Court would take. Aside from all of these factors, there's also the cases that don't get a full decision, as in they don't get a full written opinion. And these are the cases that fall onto what is known as the court's emergency or shadow docket.
Now, the shadow docket is a label that has been applied to a number of decisions that the Supreme Court makes, which are actually on their emergency docket. The Supreme Court has had an emergency docket for a very, very long time. And that emergency docket was often used for applications to stay or hold off on an execution for an individual or some sort of emergency situation where we needed a decision right away and didn't have months and months to wait on the Supreme Court to sit down and consider the arguments. As I said, for a really long time, this was a lot of death row or death penalty cases where an individual was about to be executed, and so they made an application to the Supreme Court for emergency consideration. But what's come up lately with the shadow docket, or the emergency docket, is that it has had a lot more cases where it's not so much a situation of life or death, and we need an answer right now. Some of these recent cases have had to do with kind of general federal law, maybe about abortion, maybe about immigration issues or law enforcement, and the applicants are making a request that the Supreme Court provide a blockade, in essence, on putting a law into effect. This is called a stay, or when we hold off enforcing a law. Now, if you look onto slide 22, what you will see about this shadow docket or the emergency docket is that these cases don't have the same type of process that we're going to talk about on the next few slides. And the process is really, there's no explanation, there's just a decision. Sometimes they are released in the middle of the night, their hours don't seem to be standard. The court has what are called 60 to 70 merits cases. And those are the applications that they accept based on the process I just discussed. But the emergency or shadow docket is handled much, much differently. And it's become a very big talking point because of the size and significance of the cases that are going through the emergency docket and how we don't get really any explanation from the justices as to how they decide on those emergency docket cases.
We have one additional dynamic that I want to point out. It's on the slide titled Emergency Appeals to the Supreme Court. And what you can see here is that the emergency docket or the shadow docket is now being used much more by the government to push back on, let's say, maybe lower court decisions that interrupt what the administration wants to do. So this might be cases related to immigration policy where a district court or an appeals court says, hey, this is not constitutional. And the Trump administration or the Biden administration might jump in and say, whoa, hold on. We want the Supreme Court to hold that decision from the lower level off. And then we want the Supreme Court to give their decision on the case. But while the Supreme Court is considering this, we want you to let us go ahead and do what we were doing before, at least before the district or appeals court stopped it. You can see in 2025 alone, in the second Trump administration, there are a huge number of appeals, 20 emergency appeals as of July 9th, 2025, and that number's gone only up. So this is more and more a tactic of the government to push back when maybe a lower court decision indicates that the practice of the government might be constitutionally questionable.
I'm going to stop there with discussion about the emergency or shadow docket. It is very, very interesting as a topic, but it's easy to end up going down a bit of a rabbit hole with that one, so to speak, because there is so much written about it, and it's very, very opinionated as a topic, generally speaking. Either people find good value in the emergency docket, and they'll call it the emergency docket if they support it, or they find a great threat with the shadow docket and they'll call it the shadow docket to indicate that they don't support its use and they find it as a problem. Either way, if it's something that interests you, please feel free to dig in further, but I'm going to proceed with talking now about the decision-making process used by the court once it has accepted a case to be decided. Okay, so slide 25 gives you some basic points about quote-unquote, making the case. And these are the steps by which the court receives information about the case and then comes to a final decision about it. The first step is that each side or party in the legal case files its briefs. A brief here is a legal argument in written form. Now, it isn't just that each party might file their legal argument. There might be individuals or entities who have an interest in the outcome of the case, and they want to leave their arguments with the court as well. These are called amicus briefs, or amicus curiae. Amicus curiae means friend of the court in the Latin translation. And essentially what we're doing is getting outsider input to say, okay, here are some of the legal issues we see on this case. We're not a party to the case, meaning we are not the plaintiff or the respondent, meaning we're not issuing the complaint or we're not responding to the complaint, but we do have some sort of interest in seeing how this is decided. After we get all of those written case filings, we move to oral arguments. And generally, oral arguments are no more than roughly 30 minutes to an hour for each side. And to be quite honest, those oral arguments aren't exactly what you think. We don't listen to the attorneys argue their case for half an hour, but we end up with the attorneys basically providing a summary of their case in roughly 2 to 5 minutes, and the rest of the time is left open for questions from the justices. And that's really what point four is, questioning from the justices. That all happens during the oral argument period, which is usually scheduled for one day and at most a few hours. Some extraordinary cases have had multiple days of oral arguments. This would include cases like Brown v. Board of Education on school desegregation, which actually had 3 days in which they offered the oral arguments. On slide 26, I've actually provided you with a link to the oral arguments in the Biden v. Nebraska case, which was the case around student loans and whether those could be forgiven by the executive branch. This is a nice demonstration of just how the oral arguments flow, and it's also a good way for you to experience hearing what that questioning is like. I really do recommend taking a few minutes to listen to, at least I would recommend no less than 10 minutes of the oral arguments, so you can get a sense of the back and forth between the attorneys and the justices. And the nice thing about this tool that's on OYE is it not only provides the oral or the auditory, but it also gives you a transcript of the arguments that it highlights as those arguments are being made. In the top portion of that display for the oral argument, you'll also see all of the pictures of the justices, which they actually pop out in color when the justice is speaking. So you know which justice is talking, you're able to see the words through the transcript, and you're able to hear it all. It's a pretty good stand-in for actually being able to experience it in person. And again, I just don't think there's much of a substitute for truly listening to those oral arguments. And all of the oral arguments are available for each recent Supreme Court term if you go to oyez.org, oyez.org, and look up a specific case. All right, we're coming into the home stretch of the decision-making process. We've had our oral arguments, we've read the legal briefs, and now the justices will sit down for their second case conference on this case and have some discussions around how they intend to vote. Now, discussions with Supreme Court justices aren't like arguments in a debate. Most of the time, what they are presenting is their intended vote, although there may be some discussions of the reasoning, because that's how they decide who they are going to vote with or vote for. Each justice determines how they will vote on the case, and then the majority, the side of the case which gets the most votes of the justices, is determined as the side that quote-unquote wins. And for those justices who vote with that side, they must determine who's actually going to write the opinion. Okay? Opinions are written in multiple drafts, there are several revisions, and the justices send these drafts and revisions around to get each other's feedback, so that we can eventually get to final versions of an opinion that can be distributed to the public. The process of assigning that written opinion actually falls to the most senior justice who is in the majority. So the most senior justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, by virtue of his position alone, is Justice Roberts. The Chief Justice is always considered the most senior. And then seniority for the rest of the justices is based on how long they've been on the Supreme Court. So what you see pictured on slide 28 is all of the justices from left to right in order of seniority. Justice Roberts is the most senior, although he hasn't been on the court longest. He's followed by Justice Thomas, who has been on the court longer than any other of the current justices. Then Samuel Alito, then Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and our most recently appointed Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. The steps for assigning the written opinion are bulleted out below that picture. So we take the vote and we determine which justices are in the majority. And then if the Chief Justice is in that majority, he can decide if he wants to write the opinion on the case or if he's going to assign it to someone else. If the Chief Justice is not in the majority, the next most senior justice in the majority will write or assign the opinion. So as an example, if Justice Roberts is not in the majority but Justice Thomas is, Justice Thomas would be the one deciding, does he write the opinion or does he assign it to someone else? So now we have a written opinion, it's released to the public, it's posted online, and after the decision is issued, we really don't have any systematic way of enforcing that decision. The Supreme Court possesses no independent law enforcement of its own. It really relies on voluntary compliance, and that can be very, very difficult for it when it makes decisions that are unpopular. Going back to the Brown v. Board case that I mentioned before, the decision on school desegregation was incredibly unpopular, and it took years, decades even, in some regions of the United States for states to comply with the decision. Eventually they did, but when the Supreme Court makes a decision that is considered to be wildly unpopular, you don't see a lot of voluntary compliance, at least not immediately. And I would venture to offer that on slide 31, we're going to see some of that same dynamic come to play in the future, because we are seeing an increasing number of people who have unfavorable views of the Supreme Court, or at least unfavorable opinions of it. That lack of favor actually is something that works against the court, because you really need public buy-in. We have to accept that the Supreme Court is a legitimate authority, generally speaking, before we're willing to follow its instructions. The graph on the left on slide 31 is overall public opinion, right? But on the right-hand side, what you're seeing is the division between Democrats and Republicans, or those who lean Republican and those who lean Democratic, and how much they have a favorable opinion of the Supreme Court. You'll see in 2022 that the Democratic or lean Democratic support or favorable opinion of the Supreme Court absolutely dove, took a huge downtick relative to where it had been before. And this may be in relation to contentious decisions it has made, or it may even be in relation to processes like appointments of justices that lean towards an imbalance in the court. I've been listening to some podcasts of my own lately, and there's some pretty good arguments that the changes you see, the big shifts in these opinions, is less about the contentious decision, like the decision about abortion, and more about the way we tend to see things like judicial appointments to the Supreme Court. Okay, let's bring it all home now with how are we supposed to analyze a Supreme Court opinion? And Star Wars nerd that I am, I could not avoid putting in a little photo here of Yoda on slide 33. And he's right. Break it down, you must. So the end of this chapter provides a nice way of breaking down the opinions into the case facts, the legal question or questions, the majority opinion, any other opinions like concurring opinions or dissenting opinions, and then the book asks for an evaluation of the case, but I won't go so far as that. That breakdown to reading a Supreme Court opinion is actually reflected in your layman's terms assignments. That's the structure I want you to use. So give a brief summary of the facts of the case. Why is it here in the first place? And then provide the legal question. What are they answering in this case, or what is the Supreme Court deciding on? Following that, talk about the majority decision. What did most of them, or the majority of them, or even maybe 4 out of 9, if we really can't agree, what did they say was their reasoning? And some of them are going to give different reasons at times, and those are called concurring opinions. Concurring opinions are written when someone agrees with the overall vote, but has a different reason behind their vote. Now that's very different from dissenting opinions, where a person says the vote was wrong, and here's why I think it was wrong. All of these are components you should read, and you should look for them in the cases we will read throughout the rest of the semester. It gives us a better sense of why the court thinks the way they do, or at least why they vote the way they do. For this week, I have a few practice case readings for you. These are the cases Atchison Hotels v. Laufer, FDA v. Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, and FBI v. FCRA. So what you will find when you go on Canvas is each of these case files, which is essentially the Supreme Court decision in each case, and I've walked through and highlighted sections of those decisions. I've tried to pull out some key case facts, some of the legal questions, and then identify the reasoning. There's color coding in each of those highlighted files. So read through and try to identify those. I've provided some instructions in the margins of each PDF or at the bottom to explain what my process is with highlighting those. If you have any questions about the highlighted cases as far as reading them, of course, please let me know. But what I'd like you to do is read through each one. They're not the longest decisions by far. Trust me, I've read several long Supreme Court decisions, and these are on the light end.
As you read through each case, think about the concepts that they are emphasizing. For Atchison and the FDA cases, we're talking about the concept of standing. How does that appear, or how are you understanding it from each case? And do the cases give you the same sense of standing, or how are they different? And then for FBI v. FCRA, does that help you to understand mootness, or does it more confuse it for you? Think about that, and hopefully we will have a chance to touch base and discuss more at a later point in time. Okay, everybody, that covers the material for the slides and the general contents of all of the methods by which the Supreme Court operates and functions, or maybe doesn't so, you know, well function, but that's how they go about their business. So let's take just a few minutes. I know we're going over an hour at this point in time, but a few minutes to talk about upcoming assignments. So the critical reflection papers. This is kind of similar to what I had called a layman's terms paper in the past, where you need to summarize the important case facts, you need to identify what the legal question is for the case, and then you need to describe the majority opinion and their reasoning, and then critique it, right? I want you to assess how constitutional is their argument, right? What methods of interpretation are you seeing in those cases, right? Do you agree with the reasoning first? Let's go through the order of the assignment. Apologies. Listing the opinion, you're going to do that in about two paragraphs. Then you're going to talk about whether you agree with the reasoning or not. And I want you to then go back to, okay, what are the elements of the Constitution that are talked about in the case? Are they talking about the free speech issues and therefore the First Amendment? Are they talking about the 14th Amendment and how this applies to the states? What are they talking about there? And or how are they talking about past court decisions? So here we're thinking about precedent, right? Does their approach in this case or to that constitutional issue show up similar to other decisions that we may have discussed? And then last, but certainly not least, what is the method of interpretation, or more appropriately, methods of interpretation that you're seeing in the decision? How are they explaining it? And then are they applying it in a way that seems to be consistent with that method of interpretation? So as an example, if they're saying they're originalist, are they actually doing analysis of the original intent of the founders or whoever created the law when the law was passed? Are they looking at the original understanding of the words or maybe how the public understood them? Are they doing it in a way that aligns with that method of interpretation? Or maybe are they kind of jumping around back and forth? It's very possible you will see several methods of interpretation in a decision, so highlight that, point that out. And then tell me, is it consistent or is it kind of inconsistent with what we understood before from our discussions around the methods of interpretation? Right. Next set of assignments that we need to touch base on quickly are the legal arguments. So the legal arguments are more of an in-class component. You do need to submit something before we do the in-class discussion. But really what I'm asking you to do here is, in whatever case you're assigned and for whichever side of the case you've been assigned, come to class and summarize the arguments in support of that side of the case. So if we have a question of like a Kennedy versus Bremerton case and you're assigned to argue the side of Kennedy, what are the arguments that support the coach's position? What are the pieces of evidence the coach is going to use to support his position? If you have the Bremerton school side, I'm going to ask you to do the same thing. What are the arguments for the school? And what evidence could they use to back up their position? I've given a couple of examples in the legal arguments number one and number two descriptions, where I show the structure of the written summary. And you do have to submit a written summary on the Sunday before we discuss that case in class. So make sure you get that written summary done, and then you'll have to talk about it when we get to class. I want you to also be aware, if you are given the legal arguments for the case, you should also know the case facts, the legal question, and generally how it was decided. I'm going to open it to everyone in the class to ask questions during these legal arguments, and I really want you to plan to be able to address those questions as they come up. All right, last but not least, and the final thing we're discussing in this podcast episode, is this survey for the legal arguments and critical reflection paper selections. It's a pretty straightforward assignment, but basically you're just going to tell me what you'd prefer to write your papers on or which cases you'd prefer to do the arguments for. Make sure you pay attention to which portion you are filling out, whether that's the legal arguments or the critical reflection papers. And you must get these in early enough for me to make the assignments for everyone, which means you really need to have it done by the day it's due, which is Sunday, September 7th. Make sure you get that survey in so that I can start assigning cases to everyone the Tuesday right afterwards. You are going to have some overlap with others in terms of what you select, but because I'm allowing you to make so many selections, I'm hoping to give you cases that you really want to work on for both sets of these assignments. All right, that's it. I can talk no more. And we should all be grateful for that because this is a darn long podcast episode. As always, email me with any questions or concerns, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll be back again with you soon, hopefully with a slightly shorter episode. Have a good one, everybody.